This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to our third episode of Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. Why? Because these queasy times call for humor and information while they're still allowed. We'll cover current events with a focus on Charlottesville's resistance efforts. Today, we're talking with Charlottesville immigration attorney Edward Summers, Edgar Lara, community engagement coordinator from the local nonprofit that helps immigrants Sin Barrera, and we have Dr. Mimi Arbeit, postdoctoral fellow with YouthNext at the University of Virginia, who will talk about her activism and her research. But first, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I wish I had taken a philosophy class so I could answer you with something more philosophical, but all I have is, yes, I am here.
Fantastic.
I do have something for you, though.
Yes, what is it?
In addition to my, yes, I am here. I know that saying Trump's name is bothering you tremendously, as he would say, tremendously. So I have a short list of names for you to consider. You don't have to choose any, but I just want you to know I'm on the case for you, because even if he's only here for another month, cross our fingers, I want you to have something, perhaps, you know, to refer to him by, rather than, I can't name, you know, rather than
okay.
the litany of, okay, so here they are.
I'm with you.
In no particular order.
Mm-hmm.
This first one I cannot take credit for because I've seen it on Twitter. Dolt 45, as he is. All right, there you
go. Okay.
Hair, as in German, hairdo,
mm-hmm.
Lotus,
mm-hmm.
Cheeto in Chief.
Yes.
All right. Let me just tuck these in for layaway. Diaper Don, Colonel Chaos, Premier Puppet, Poop Emoji, or the Doorknob.
What's your favorite?
I'm partial to, I like the Cheeto in Chief. I'm with you. Let's do it, you know, let's sync up.
Okay. Well, is that what I'm supposed to use? I was thinking of, like, Decoy in Chief lately.
Decoy in Chief. Is it dark enough? I mean, he is a decoy.
Yeah,
oh, you mean like he's a puppet? He's
yeah.
like Bannon's. Okay. All right. So from now on, when you pass me information,
that's how I'll refer to him.
Mm-hmm.
Cheeto does come slip off the tongue nicely, though, so I might go with that.
Well, actually, I do have, look at these notes. I do have one more for
okay.
you, but it's longer. It's more stately. President asterisk and the with a double S on the ass on the asterisk.
Uh-huh. You get, nice.
Exactly.
Nice way to come across
and a visual,
the radio.
And you never literally say his name. It's a little anyway. You see where I'm going with
mm-hmm.
that. So Decoy in Chief.
Yes. Decoy.
Right.
Decoy in Chief. Or, I say Drumpf a lot. I don't know how people feel about that, but that's what also I think about. That was his real name at one point.
I have seen John Oliver give the history. Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you have any other names for me? Because I'm
no,
just
those.
Wondering.
<Where's that? laughs>
I mean, I don't want to cut you off. Like our theme music. Do you know we have theme music?
Yeah, I do know we have theme music. I was listening to it before you introduced me, yeah.
Oh, cool. So it's called Springtide, out of Japan.
Right, it's Japan, so, you know, I'm kind of worried. It's been on my mind that we're going to have to pay an import tax on that because of Trump.
So the title is N354019800. I wish they had a more interesting title for us, but it's from the album This Is the End, and that title is sometimes appropriate. So I wanted to mention... Nancy, do you have any other tidbits before I get rolling here?
Ellen, I think the rolling is in order.
Okay. So I have two
sure.
activism events I wanted to mention. So on Sunday, that's tomorrow at 4, there's going to be a screening of Jerry Rigged, sponsored by One Virginia 2021. It's a documentary, a PBS documentary about the history of gerrymandering in Virginia and the steps to reform. It's at the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church. And then Indivisible Charlottesville is holding a town hall with or without a congressman. They're inviting Tom Garrett to show up. That's Sunday, February 26th, next weekend, at 2, Charlottesville High School. their mission, Indivisible's mission, is to resist the Trump agenda by putting pressure on local elected officials. I really like that. They can be found on Facebook at Indivisible Charlottesville. So here on Apropos of Something, we're grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams, and we have an amazing show to get started with. Our first guest is sitting right in front of me. His name is, he is an attorney. His name is Summers is a graduate of UVA Law and has practiced immigration law exclusively for 12 years. He represents clients before U.S. Immigration Services, the Department of State, and the immigration courts, as well as individuals who are detained by ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Summers also teaches immigration law at Washington and Lee University School of Law. Welcome, Edward.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks exactly for being in front of Ellen. We really appreciate you being here. I will ask you my first question, and considering yesterday's news as well, meaning the rumor anyway of Trump employing the National Guard perhaps to take care of immigration raids. So my question to you, sir, is what do you find most alarming about the raids that the Trump administration is doing?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that raids in general are not a new thing. Under President Bush, there were workplace raids. Those kind of went away under Obama. Obama targeted his enforcement slightly differently. Most of the raids that are taking place right now are being conducted by what are called fugitive operations teams, and the idea is that these are immigration agents who are putting together lists of wanted individuals that they then go out to find. Unfortunately, if you're not one of those wanted individuals, you may get sort of caught up in this because sometimes ICE doesn't have up-to-date data. People who are wanted for deportation oftentimes don't leave a forwarding address, and when ICE shows up and says, we're looking for Mr. X doesn't live here anymore, well, let's talk to everybody who's in the house and see what your situation is, and those folks sort of get caught up in it. As far as using the National Guard, it's a dramatic statement, but I honestly can't imagine how to make that work. Using the National Guard in an emergency is great because National Guardsmen are trained to do things like direct traffic and use heavy equipment for natural disaster issues and so on. They're not trained in immigration enforcement. They're not trained necessarily in how to conduct investigations or identify people's status or even how to arrest large numbers of people. So they could, if it could actually happen, I suppose they could just be a large force holding people, but it's not clear how they could actually be effective in enforcing the law.
Well, you know, it might not be a rumor, I get that, but really, I mean, that whole administration, they're doing is hiring people that aren't, you know, competent for their jobs. It would not surprise me if this rumor was actually, you know, dropped intentionally, because it's just another level of his way to show just how he's got it all figured out and keep us on our toes and, you know, scare everyone. But, you know, I've read that the, Bush and Obama both have done extensive raids of their own. I just wondered, what else, you know, for instance, I did read that the classification for deporting, you know, or at least detaining immigrants is wide open. I know you're going to correct me, so I don't think you even need to be accused of a crime. You just have to be suspected of one. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's one of the, if you're worried about these kinds of things, that's one of the serious concerns. Under President Bush, there were fewer sort of guidelines, I think. And under Obama, there was a sort of a targeting of criminal aliens. So under Obama, there was an increase in the use of these immigration priorities where ICE agents were instructed to focus on people with certain serious criminal charges or previous deportation orders, that kind of thing, and to not ignore, but to focus less on people who didn't have who didn't meet those priorities. The proposal from in one of the executive orders would expand the number of people counted as a priority to basically everybody. It's people who have criminal charges without distinction about the severity of the criminal charges. It can include people who have been charged but not convicted. It can include people who have not been charged if the ICE officers believe that they may be a threat or may have committed a crime. And so it really does expand it to everybody. And the problem with expanding enforcement to everybody, especially when you've got limited resources, is then it just becomes a sort of a crapshoot as to who they pick up.
Yeah, all of that sounds to me like I would be petrified, or maybe a notch below, I'm not sure, because it's, anyway, to walk outside for, you know, I would definitely consider when and where I go, only because I'd be afraid if I have the wrong color skin, then I would possibly get picked up by, you know, whether by accident, as you know, the way you described, or just in general, that it doesn't take much, you know, to find yourself all of a sudden detained.
Yeah, for those of us who've been doing this for a while, the current situation is feeling a little bit like a return to the way things used to be. So as President Obama came in, again, he moved away from workplace raids, and he targeted enforcement a little bit more. Now, that doesn't mean that President Obama was necessarily better. President Obama ended up deporting more people than any other president before him. He is at its peak. Removals under President Obama were nearly twice what they were under previous administrations. But under President Bush, the Center for Migration Policy looked at people who were picked up by these fugitive operations teams. And under President Bush, without that sort of targeting to focus on people who actually had criminal records and so on, they found that during the Bush era, roughly or nearly two-thirds of the people who were picked up as fugitive aliens, criminal aliens, actually had no criminal record at all. And in 2009, only 9% of the people who were arrested were actually fugitive criminal aliens. Now, again, that changed under President Obama. You can argue whether or not he was actually picking up people that we should be concerned about because of the way they define criminal aliens, but at least under Obama, that was more targeted. This is potentially going back to a more sort of catch-what-you-can kind of attitude.
I hear you. And has this, you know, new or, you know, revised pact from the Trump administration, has it actually, I was wondering if it affected your office, meaning like the clients you hear from, or have new clients surfaced as a result?
It has already started to affect things, and it will probably affect things more in the future. Before the policies came out under Obama and there was a shift, I should mention, first of all, that the majority of people who get picked up by immigration are picked up through what's called the criminal alien program. So they're picked up because they've been entered into the jail. They got arrested for some reason, and whether they're being ultimately convicted or not, that's how they come into ICE's attention. Roughly maybe 20%, the numbers aren't great, but maybe 20% of the people who are picked up by ICE are actually picked up by these raids. So the majority are coming through the criminal system anyway. A big effect under Obama was that people who ended up in the criminal system for minor offenses oftentimes were not picked up right away by ICE, or maybe not at all, especially if they had lots of equities, like they'd been here a long time and otherwise clean criminal records and family and that kind of thing. Under the previous administration, that wasn't the case. Under the previous administration, if you got picked up for some minor offense and actually had to spend the night in jail, there was a really good chance that ICE was going to pick you up, and there you go. And it seems like this may be a return to that older...
Yeah.
I just want to say, for anyone who just tuned in, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with attorney Edward Summers. He does exclusively immigration law here in Charlottesville. A little bit later, we're going to talk with Edgar, very soon actually, Edgar Lara from Sin Barreras, and then Dr. Mimi Arbeit. So once again, thank you, Edward, for being here. And I had a quick question. What happens when they're, you know, deported? What happens to them at that moment? Where are they taken? Where do they go?
That's a great thing to lay out here, because one of the things that the administration is sort of pushing is we're going to get out there and we're going to pick up more people, we're going to detain more people. That's just the beginning of the process. The process for removal is actually reasonably long and complicated. And for many people who are picked up in the United States, those people are going to have a right to a bond, potentially, if they're detained by ICE. They're going to have the right to contest their removal in front of an immigration judge. And the immigration courts right now have a backlog of about 500,000 cases. So the whole process of actually getting someone between the time they get detained and the time they are ordered removed and actually removed, depending on the court and depending on the person's options and what they can apply for to try and forestall that removal, it can take years to actually get people removed, and it's expensive to detain them. Again, they may have the right to a bond, so they may not be detained the whole time. Some people will sign up and say, fine, I don't want to sit in jail, just go ahead and send me home. Other people are going to fight it out, and unless there are substantial additions to the number of judges and the courts and the immigration system, these removals can take many years.
So if someone is detained and they don't have the means, are you saying they, you know, they're potentially kept away from, you know, their families in for all of that processing time?
Again, it's going to depend. People who are detained are prioritized through the system, so their cases will move much faster. So if you're actually physically detained by ICE, you'll probably work through your case in 6 months to a year at most. If you're not detained, however, you're a lower priority because the government's not paying to keep you locked up, and your case could drag out for 2 years or more, depending on your situation. My point is just that arresting people is, to some extent, the easy part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agree. they're doing that. And is there a difference between an undocumented immigrant and an illegal immigrant? Are they the same or are they different?
There might be some way to distinguish between the two, but in general, undocumented is how immigration practitioners tend to refer to people who lack legal status. Illegal immigrant tends to be the way, to some extent, the general public and the government refers to people. And I think it's really just a matter of terminology. Anyone who is in the United States, at a bare minimum, who lacks current legal status can be deported. Now, some people, when they talk about illegal immigrants, they mean people who cross the border illegally, without a visa, without inspection. But in the legal sense, it's anyone who doesn't have current legal status. That could be someone who came legally, who overstayed a visa, who came legally but violated the terms of the visa, who had a visa but lost it for criminal charges, or who never had any visa status in the first place.
I'm going to break in here and say that we need to go to a hard break right now.
Right.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio. We're talking with Attorney Edward Summers. After the break, we're going to be talking with Edgar Lara from Sin Barreras. He is a community engagement coordinator there, has lots of interesting things to say. And then we'll talk to Dr. Mimi Arbeit after this. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio. I'm Ellen Daniels, here with my co-host, Nancy Lawrence. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Edgar Lara. Nancy, are you there?
I
had you all the way.
I didn't want to talk over the Japanese music we have to pay for, apparently.
Yes, no pay. As long as we give credit, we're good.
Okay. Well, listen, I wanted to ask you, I know we don't have much time, but I want to ask you, in terms of the week, looking back, every day is like, is this a crisis? You know, what's happening? So in looking back, I've come up with one disaster that is still, you know, that sticks with me still, and that one, and I hope you have one. The one I'm thinking of happened actually last Saturday night in Florida. The Trump's Mar-a-Lago dinner with the side order of national security meeting. Mm-hmm. I thought that was quite incredible. Those pictures, I'm sure you saw some of them on Facebook or Twitter or somewhere, of Trump wanting everyone to see him, you know, making America great again, by smartphone light. Anyway, that's the one from last week, that the disaster that I remember. What about you?
It's a great one. Mine for the detractor in chief, or the decoy in chief, is that he was asked, I think by an Israeli reporter, about the rise of anti-Semitism since his election, and the very next thing out of his mouth was quoting his Electoral College numbers.
I saw that. I saw that clip. I could not, yeah.
It was like stark. Thanks for that. So Edgar Lara is with Sin Barreras, a local nonprofit organization helping immigrants. He is a community engagement coordinator and member of the Hispanic community here in Charlottesville. Welcome, Edgar.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Hey, Edgar. I've got the first question for you. I wanted, before I ask you about the work you're doing at Sin Barreras, I wanted to ask about your background and how you and your family came to the United States.
My mother came to the United States in the 70s. She came here from Mexico and was undocumented. She was undocumented when she had me. I'm a U.S. citizen. She's now a U.S. citizen. Happened years later. I'm not even sure when it happened, but it was sometime during high school, I believe. But I'm also a United States Marine. And this is not uncommon at all. There's a huge community in the Marine Corps and military that shares this story.
The story that you were born here and your mother was not, is that, or what do you mean?
They come from an undocumented history.
Right. Is your mother safe? I know she's been here forever, but that doesn't seem to matter anymore. So what do you feel about that?
Well, she's a U.S. citizen, but even people that, now she's a citizen. She's become a citizen. But it doesn't really matter. There's people with legal status and citizens from this community that still feel the anxiety. I grew up. I've been a citizen. I was born here, and I felt the anxiety as a child, and I still feel it now for the community because I'm with them, and we all feel it.
I hear you. And how did you wind up? How long have you been with Sin Barreras, and how did that organization actually come to be?
I've lived in Charlottesville for a little over 4 years, and I found Sin Barreras about 2 years ago. It didn't take me long to see how this community, the Latino immigrant community here, was pretty much invisible. And I worried about how they were going to survive here. And I wondered why there wasn't any support for them. So when I found Sin Barreras 2 years ago, I thought it was great and amazing. It's unfortunate that they're not larger and there aren't other organizations that focus on this community and try to help in some way, but Sin Barreras has given me a way to help this community as well.
What other professionals, what is the staff like? What kind of people are working on its behalf? I understand the volunteers, but who else is part of this team?
Yeah, so we're all volunteers. We have volunteer attorneys, professionals, students of all types. One of the things that we do is provide direct services in our office. These attorneys and some other representatives, they provide consultations. We call it a low-cost donation because if they don't have money, they don't have to pay. But usually it's a $25 fee for a consultation, which is incredibly reasonable. If the representatives or the attorneys can handle their issue in that session, then great. If they need to do some follow-up and come back for another session, that's good too. If they actually need the help of an attorney, sometimes, many times they don't. There's often times when I can help them navigate whatever problem they're dealing with. But when they actually need help from a professional and from an attorney, that's when we schedule an appointment with them, and they get the help they need.
You know, you mentioned that there aren't many, if any, other agencies in Charlottesville, you know, that were addressing the immigrant concerns. And so I was wondering how, if you can give me a couple examples, or doesn't have to be examples, of how, you know, SimbraRS becomes part of the community, you know, how it does that.
Well, first of all, we're here. We're open to all immigrants that call us. We provide a space where they are welcome and they're treated with respect. Unfortunately, there's not enough of that in our country and even our community. I'm sure people treat them with respect, or some people do. Many agencies do. But we welcome all of them. We don't turn anyone away. We may not be able to help every one of them, but we also connect people to other services. And there are times where maybe they can't even get any help, and maybe we can't help them either. But what we do is maybe just give them a hug, and we have people. We might even have to cry with them sometimes, and just sympathize and provide a shoulder.
Have you noticed more interest or more traffic into the organization from immigrants? Because of the Trump executive order,
over the past few weeks, the calls that we receive, it's tripled, and we're working to try to manage that. We need to figure out. We're trying to grow. We don't expect the demand to decrease anytime soon. It's going to continue to increase. So we're a small organization, and we're trying to grow. To try to manage the demand, and the help of volunteers is how we do it, or how we're going to do it.
And in your, you know, in your daily life, I'm sure you, if it includes beyond going, the Charlottesville area, how do you feel walking around, or, you know, are you aware, do you feel that difference from Trump empowering people to, you know, show their hate?
Well, yeah, lately I've pretty much been consumed in the work that I do. I haven't walked around much. I've just been focusing on this. And one of the feelings that I've had recently, I've gone to several meetings with a lot of well-meaning people, and I've had this growing frustration that I didn't know why, but the reason, I put words to it recently, but in these conversations with the well-meaning people that have compassion for the community that I'm talking about, oftentimes when the undocumented community comes up, the conversation gets steered away from them. They change the subject because they're not fully, although we all support refugees and all our vulnerable communities, when it comes to undocumented immigrants, many of these compassionate people don't fully support because they do think they're wrong for being here. And that's a frustration of mine because many people don't understand how it's the system that's wrong and not these people. It doesn't apply to reality. And that's one of the frustrations that I've had. And one of the things people can do is try to take a closer look and become more aware of the reality. This community has contributed to our prosperity from the first time we encountered them. They've contributed all along, and they're not the ones that are wrong. It's the system.
Yes, we're talking with Edgar Lara from Sin Barreras, and I wanted to know if you could give just a little history of that. Like you alluded to how people came here in the first place, and some of the history of those people.
Yeah, it's a long history, and every Latin American country has a different history. It's a shared history, but each country has a different story. I'll start just with talking about Mexico because it represents the largest population. And most people think they know the story of the Mexican undocumented immigrant, but maybe they don't realize or think about how really we've deported Mexicans since we first laid eyes on them. There was Manifest Destiny, and once there was the Mexican-American War and the U.S. won, the Mexicans, the former Mexicans that remained, they became U.S. citizens, and they had property, they had all these rights, but those rights weren't honored. A lot of them didn't speak the language. If they had proper documentation and documents that for their properties, they were taken to court, and in the court, if they can't fully understand or speak the language, it didn't go well for them. And the ones that could hang on to their property, they spent all their money on legal fees and were eventually cheated out of their property anyway. And others that didn't have good documentation, of course, they lost it. And the fact that many of them were citizens didn't matter. Many were deported anyway. And that's happened throughout our history. We have a history of recruiting the labor force when we need them, but then shipping them out when we don't anymore. And whether they were citizens or not didn't matter. And
said earlier that, you know, the problem is the system. It's not the people. You know, they're contributing in various ways to the community. They're paying their taxes. They're going to school and all this. And, you know, this is what, to your said, one of many, you know, I am not diminishing it. I am not, you know, it's one of those tragic stories that the people in power can do, you know, apparently with an executive order. Do you know anyone at Cimbaras? Are they DACA enrollees or Dreamers or any of them?
We have some volunteers that are in DACA. We have several volunteers. Some of the people that are most involved are not. We all have status, and there's many people from non-Hispanic backgrounds, or we're mostly made up of volunteers that don't have Hispanic backgrounds. We could use anyone's help. And earlier we talked about terminology and undocumented and illegal. Well, I see illegal as a way to dehumanize, and it makes it easy to treat them the way we do. And I think that's the primary difference to me. Illegal makes them less than human. Undocumented, we're talking about people.
I got you. I do. Have any ICE agents, are you aware of any that have shown up? Anyone that you know of or secondhand, has that happened yet?
I'm not aware of any around here. Not yet.
I wanted to give Edgar a chance just to give some information. If people want to volunteer, I know you guys really could use the help now or contribute in some way.
Yeah, we're a small organization, and one thing that we haven't done well or focused on was fundraising. We're made up of many dedicated volunteers, but we need funds. We're trying to grow to meet needs, and I would say if there was anyone out there listening that has experience in fundraising, we could definitely use your help. We could definitely use donations, but if we had someone that could help us figure out our program, because I think there are people that have compassion and would like to support us, we just don't, we haven't been good at providing a way for others to support us.
Mm-hmm. How can they reach you?
The best way would be to visit our website. It's sinbarrerascivil.com. That's sinbarrerascivil.com. They can also call us at 434-531-0104.
Could you say that one more time?
The number?
Mm-hmm.
It's 434-531-0104. We're overwhelmed with calls, but if you leave a message, we will get back to you as soon as we can.
Mm-hmm. And you can reach the station also, 94.7 WPVC, and we can put you in touch for sure. Again, you're listening to Progressive Radio, Resistance Radio here at 94.7. We're talking with Edgar Lara from Cimbareras, and we will be talking with Dr. Mimi Arbeit shortly. Nancy, I think we have time for another question, or if Edgar wants to, I think Edgar wanted to make a point.
Can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
So I started to talk about some of the history of Mexico, but there's many other histories. Like I was saying earlier, there's Central America. Central America has a very tragic history with us, and many people think, why is it our problem? But that's because they don't realize that we have contributed it in many ways, and our U.S. corporations have continued to benefit throughout. People don't just immigrate, they're fleeing Central America especially, and in huge numbers as a result. And we're not, our hands are not clean of this. So I would urge people to take a closer look, become more familiar. And I do have one recommendation that's pretty easy for anyone to do. There's a documentary out there called Harvest of Empire. It's available for free online. I have multiple copies of it. And if anyone out there wants to borrow one, I'd be happy to give it to them. I'd be happy to join them even. I don't know that I can. It's really busy, but I'd love to hear feedback from people after watching it. And it's great to watch as a group, but this is it doesn't tell the whole story. It begins to tell the story because the story hasn't ended. There's Central America specifically. It's very dangerous there for many people. It's very difficult to live. And if we deport people back into that situation, they're afraid for their lives.
Yeah, I think these are great points to point out the history for people to become educated about how the United States has been contributing to the problem. It's not just about sound bites that people hear on certain other networks. So thank you for pointing that out, and would love to learn more. We're going to go to a break just in a moment, and then we'll be back with Dr. Mimi Arbeit. I want to say thank you to Edgar Lara. Is there anything else? Did you have another website? I just want to give you.
Well, there's also our email address, but if they go to our website,
It's pretty easy to Google, even if you can't spell that, or contact the station here. Our phone number is 284-9470. We'll be right back after this. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Apropos of Something here on 94.7 Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We were talking about the deportation crisis, and we're going to shift a little bit right now. We're talking with our next guest, Dr. Mimi Arbeit. Dr. Arbeit earned her doctorate in human development from Tufts University, focusing on adolescent sexuality, relationships, and sexual violence prevention. She is committed to resistance and the movement for Black lives. We're going to give some of her contact information a little bit later, but I'll just plug it right now as well. You can reach her at Mimi Arbeit or MimiArbeit.com. Welcome, Mimi.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really exciting to be here.
Yes.
Thanks for being here. The question I first had for you was about the gender justice. How did that become a focus for you?
So I think as a white feminine person, gender was one of the first and most primary ways in which I experienced injustice. So as a teenager, in relation to body image, in relation to how I was being teased by boys in my high school, to how I was navigating images of myself in the future, in career, in family, this was a very stark aspect of injustice that I faced, and I started to learn about and talk about, and also found that the more I talked about it, the more I got shut down and experienced even more kinds of gender-based harassment and sexual harassment. And later, in high school and in college, experiencing gender as a fun thing too, finding ways that gender and sexuality could be really fun and a source of pleasure. So that justice is addressing the injustice we see and also finding these sources of joy and celebration and connection in our lives.
And as far as, you know, your background, what led you, is it just the, anyway, is it just the experiences that you described, or are there any other reasons that inspired you to, you know, to focus your efforts this way?
I am a great example of the success of youth development programs. So I started as a teenager doing gender justice education and continued in college. I taught health education classes to high schoolers, and I was an HIV counselor to other college students on my campus. So I was active in addressing these issues and figuring out what kinds of access to education young people needed, and talking to other young people like myself and realizing that we really didn't have what we needed at all to navigate our sexual choices, to build the close and joyful relationships that we dreamed of. So I committed myself to figuring out how to get that.
Mm-hmm. And now that you're on the other side of the you may still be writing a thesis or something, I apologize, but now that you're virtually on the other side of the education part, do you think that schools are the best place to teach sex ed?
That's a great question. I did finish my thesis 2 years ago, thank goodness.
Okay.
And I think schools are an essential place to teach sex ed. I think trying to figure out how to get good sex ed into schools can help us change a lot that also needs to be changed about the school system, changing the environment of schools, changing how young people are treated, changing how gender and harassment is addressed in schools. And I think we need to be talking to young people about gender and sexuality and relationships everywhere. We need to figure out how to bring this conversation into religious contexts, into after-school programs, into sports teams, into families. We need to just have a wide variety of resources, because this is part of all aspects of who we are as humans.
Have you been approached by schools, or do you pursue them? How does that, you know, how do you get that the school's interest?
Both, I would say. All of the above. Yeah, if there are schools around that want to talk about gender and sexuality and promoting healthy relationships and preventing sexual violence, and how that fits into a broader anti-oppression approach, then... Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, and what happens at your workshops and consultations? What are your goals for the things that you actually control completely, you know, that are yours?
Yeah, I work to open up space for people to think deeply about how this impacts ourselves and the systems we live in. So one of the key things that I've learned over the years of working with schools is that when we talk about sex ed, we're not just talking about adolescent sexuality. We're talking about human sexuality more broadly, and all of the adults that work with young people, our own sexuality is implicated when we're talking about what our sex ed policy is and how we support healthy relationships and sexual decision making among young people, because we've also grown up in a really toxic culture, and we also have a lot of our own trauma and a lot of our own stereotypes and assumptions and baggage. So in my workshops and consultation, I try to support the adults who are in relationship with young people in doing some of that work for ourselves and figuring out what we need for ourselves to be able to come to the table more honestly.
I mean, that is such a good point about the toxic culture, obviously. So because of that, I was wondering, do you... In your research and studies and workshops, do you get the sense that kids today versus adults, you know, the next generation, but do you get the sense that kids today are understanding more the value of sexual empowerment, or or you know, do we still match each other? You know, adults and kids.
That's a great question, and I think there's a narrative that we want to tell that it's getting better, that kids are getting more empowered, and I think there's complexity to that. And if what we want is to empower young people, then we need to look at the systems of power in which young people are living. And it's our responsibility as the adults who have power within those systems to make sure that we're supporting the developmental potential of young people. And if we have so many examples, look at Teen Vogue, look at the coverage of the resistance and the coverage of this Republican administration that Teen Vogue is doing. Look at the Black Youth Project, BYP 100, and just read what young people are writing about themselves and their lives and what's going on in the world. And youth have inherent empowerment if we get out of their way.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. You're listening to 94.7. The show is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Dr. Mimi Arbeit.
And, you know, about that power, I obviously have been reading about you, and I know that you, one of the things that drew you to work with kids were those that were marginalized by what you call heterosexism and white supremacy. And I was curious why you see those two as the driving, you know, evil foes together. How are they connected?
How are they connected?
Yeah.
Yeah. So these are not my insights. These are insights that I've learned from following the leadership of women of color and queer people of color who have been writing about systems of oppression, who've been leading the resistance to systems of oppression for much, much longer than any of us have been alive. And as a white person, I've had to really look at the role that white supremacy plays in gender and sexuality, and see that the way that I've taught to be female and to be feminine is a white femininity, and what that means to me in my life, and what that means for me building relationships and building a movement that can then work to dismantle white supremacy and heterosexism together.
How can you say what, you know, how does that dismantling happen?
How does that dismantling happen? So I think naming it is a huge step. I am doing a lot of work with other white people to figure out how we talk about our whiteness and how we talk about our identities and figure out what it means to be people who are racially privileged right now, and how we can use whiteness to undermine racism in the U.S. and to also heal ourselves from the restrictions that come with these stereotypes and lessons that we've been taught our entire lives.
That helps. Thanks. I appreciate that. And, you know, you mentioned the Trump administration, and of course their focus on extremely restricting women's rights. So I was wondering, are you spending more time engaged in activism than research right now? Or anyway, that's my question.
Well, I don't want to compare the two.
Right. Understood.
But I am spending an increasing amount of time on activism. I'm feeling an incredible urgency right now to organize and to act and to make sure that we are connected to each other so that we can stand by each other, because we're all going to need it at different moments. Things are coming at us so fast that the more we can hold hands, the stronger we're going to be. So I am new to Charlottesville. I got here in July, and I'm working on building relationships, personal relationships. I think the emotional resilience is a key part of resistance, and connecting and plugging into local movements as deeply as I can.
Yeah, I thought you were taking notes when Edgar was talking about, you know, his contact information, and I just love that we're sitting here together, and it's so important. I've learned because of this election that to reach out and to connect in places that we never just, it's just because it's just not convenient, comfortable. We really have to go out of our way to do that, it's just not the people that we may socialize with. So to break out of that is something that I'm trying to do, and I think that's a really important point to make. So thank you for all your activism that you've been involved in.
Yeah, and for explaining, you know, the complexity of it, you know, that it's all connected. But I do appreciate giving some examples of that, just because, you know, it's enlightening. It was for me anyway. So thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yes, so this is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Resistance Radio. We're really trying to talk about a lot of the activism that goes on in this program to bring people together, to give voice to otherwise marginalized communities, people, organizations. So if you are one of those people, please contact us at the station. We would love to talk with you and hear and connect with you. So I wanted
to. Ellen, yeah, wasn't there a blog for Mimi as well?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Nancy.
Sure. Yeah.
So you
Thanks.
Can read, there's so much Mimi is involved with. This is really the tip of the iceberg, I think, and we'll have her back, as well as Edgar. I would love to do that. Mimi's blog is mimiarbeit.com. That's mimiarbeit.com. And you can follow her at mimiarbeit. Thanks for that. And thank you for being here. I'd like to thank our other guest, Attorney Edward Summers, and again, Edgar Lara from Sin Barreras, and of course, Dr. Mimi Arbeit. Next week, we are taking a break, and we'll be back March 4th. I wanted to let people know about that. And you can listen to podcasts if you happen to have missed the first two shows. You can go to the website at 947wpvc.org.
So do we have time for a palate cleanser?
Sure. Ellen? What do you got? What do you
All
got?
All right. I got one. I want to try and get the current events of the week away before we say goodbye to our listeners. So mine is that baseball returns this week. All pitchers and catchers have reported for spring training, and I am looking forward to baseball. And I'm pretty sure that Trump will not be throwing out a first pitch because I just don't think he has it in him. So I think baseball will remain a pastime I can enjoy.
I know it makes you happy.
Yeah.
I'm happy for you. I can't really enjoy the same thrill about baseball, but I do like the crack of a bat. I'm going to D.C. For non-political reasons after the show, and I'm looking forward to playing a little touch football with my nephews. That gives me a lot of joy. And maybe making a salad.
Get your greens on, girl. Good.
Greens are important. So I just want to say thank you also to Nancy for piping in from New York City. I know it's not the easiest thing to do to be on the phone. You can't see what's going on. So thank you. And everyone, join us back for Apropos of Something, 94.7, March 4th. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something.